continued fractions. And so, again, this is the procedure that you should have in mind. I mean, when you're solving, you're given a hard problem, okay? So step one, you insert an epsilon into the hard problem, okay? And then step two, you look for the answer to the hard problem as a function of epsilon, because now you don't have one hard problem, you have an infinite number of hard problems, okay? And this is, the answer has some form, like a sub n epsilon to the n, okay? And the subtlety here is this thing here, that equal sign, okay? Because you can only say something is equal to something else if the something else exists, okay? And so only if this series converges are you allowed to write an equal sign. If we have time in this course, I will show you what, do you know what symbol you have to use there? That's right. You have to use not this symbol, but in general that symbol, okay? And that symbol is read is asymptotic to. This symbol means is, okay, is asymptotic to. And you cannot write that symbol unless you associate that with a limit. So you say this series is asymptotic to the answer that you're trying to find in the limit as epsilon goes to 0. And in fact, it may only be in the limit as epsilon, that it may often be a one-sided limit in the limit as epsilon goes to 0 plus. Okay? So this is not a limit in all possible directions in the complex plane. It's typically a limited limit. Okay? And so the question is, how do we get the information out of the series? And the usual technique, so this is not necessarily the best technique, but what I talked about last time was that to extract the information from the series, because remember, you can't add up the series. So it's only a formal sum. It's a series in the sense of an asymptotic series, which I have not defined for you. Okay? So which, if possible, we'll talk about. So to get the answer, what you do is you convert this series to another representation which is more useful. Okay? So what do I mean by the fact that this series doesn't converge? I mean that if you construct the partial sums of that series, let's call it Sn. Okay? Sn, you can write an equal sign because I'm only going to add up a finite number of terms, so that's perfectly okay. Sn is defined as the limit as n goes to capital N, limit the sum taken from little n goes from 0 to capital N of a sub n epsilon to the n. The limit of these partial sums does not exist, okay? Limit as n goes to infinity almost always of Sn does not exist, okay? Almost always. For essentially all interesting problems, that limit does not exist. So what we do instead is we convert this series to a more convenient representation, okay? And what I mean, so what we're going to be talking about today is the representation where this is equal in some sense. And again, this is not an equal sign, but is really some sort of asymptotic sign, okay? To b0 over 1 plus b1 x over, or epsilon, over 1 minus b2 epsilon over 1 minus b3 epsilon, and so on. Okay? And this is called a continued fraction. Okay? How do we determine the b's? Well, if you love fancy things, mathematics, you know, I showed you the relationship between the A's and the B's yesterday. You could use your IQ test to do that, but you don't have to. You can be very mundane. All you need to do is to take this series, this structure here, it's not a series, but this structure, this continued fraction, truncated after n terms, okay? So what you can do is you truncate the left side by the sum from n equals 0 to capital N, okay? And then a sub n epsilon to the n, okay? And you truncate the right-hand side, b0 over 1 minus b1 epsilon over 1 minus b2 epsilon da-da-da-da over 1 minus bn epsilon. So you notice you have n a's over here and n b's over here. Okay? And then what you do is you take this object and you tailor, expand that object, and you compare the first n plus 1, capital N plus 1 terms on the left, on the right, with the capital N plus 1 terms on the left. And that gives you a set of simple algebraic formulas that allow you to convert the A's into the B's. Okay? And what you generally find is that the B's, these B coefficients, are much, much better behaved. They don't grow anywhere near as rapidly as the A's, which is a really interesting fact. Okay? And then the next thing you do is you evaluate this sequence. So you evaluate the continued fraction sequence. Okay? And the point here, the reason that this is perfect for solving problems in physics, is that, remember, you have taken an infinitely difficult problem and reduced it using perturbation theory to an infinite sequence of problems that you can solve. But you can only solve a finite number of them. You can't solve an infinite number of them. So you only know a finite number of the coefficients a sub n, say 5 of them. But if you know 5 a's, you immediately know 5 b's. Okay. Now that you know 5 b's, you then write down the sequence. So this is the conversion here. This is the conversion to continued fraction. And now that you know, let's say, 5 or 3 or 17 b's, whatever, you can now write down the following sequence. The first term in the sequence is b0. The second term in the sequence is b0 over 1 minus b1 epsilon. The next term is b0 over 1 minus b1 epsilon over 1 minus b2 epsilon, and so on. And what I claim is that this approaches the answer. This has a limit. This often, very often, the limit exists. And that deserves 3 exclamation points, because the Taylor partial sums of the Taylor series did not exist. But very often, this limit does exist. And furthermore, it's sensible, okay? That is to say, it gives you the answer you're looking for. Yeah? It converges. It, depending on the nature of the problem you're solving, sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. But it turns out for many physical problems, it converges very fast. And you're going to see it converges in a wonderful way. That is, it converges, it oscillates about the correct answer and provides an upper bound on the error by oscillating about the answer. We're going to talk about that today. Okay? It doesn't always do that. So, but for a very wide class of functions, important class of functions, it does. Yeah?
Is there a way to formulate quantum field theory that instead of getting a Taylor series, we actually get a
right. So people have, that's a very interesting question, and people have actually worked on that specific question. So the question is, can we go directly to continued fraction form? And the answer is basically no. People have tried, but there isn't any. So, of course, you see, when you're doing calculations, perturbative calculations, it's much easier to represent the answer as a Taylor series. Why is it easier? Because these A's, this A, can be constructed from Feynman diagrams. And that's basically the only technique we know, the only solid technique in quantum field theory. There's some other techniques, but they're really tricky. They're large N expansions and non-perturbative techniques. But this is a large generic procedure, and it's basically the only one we have in quantum field theory for just solving a quantum field theory perturbatively. And A sub N generally represents the sum of all the Feynman diagrams having N vertices. Okay, that's and we're going to do that in this class. You're going to see that happen. Okay? So typically, that limit exists, okay, and actually gives you the answer to the problem. And that is finally the procedure. So you've seen pieces of this. You've seen it from the start. And this is the reason why, I mean, this is the mathematics that's been developed over the last, essentially, the last half century to solve hard, really hard problems, namely the problem of how to solve a quantum field theory. It's a really hard problem. And many other kinds of problems as well, like fluid mechanics problems and so on. Okay, so that's, now you have an overview, and what we have to talk about is just what is this sequence and how do we know it converges and what's the mathematics behind it. And I'm going to give you a taste, but I'm not going to go really into the rigorous proofs of some of these theorems because they're long and they're quite difficult, quite sophisticated stuff. The mathematician, I guess, who's most responsible for developing what I'm going to show you is Stieltjes. Okay, and many of you know the name Stieltjes. Okay, so that's the idea. Okay, so so the first thing is let's look at what form this sequence takes, and you're going to see that it takes a very interesting form. So look at the first term in the series. First term is just a number. It's just B0. It's just a number. The second term is a number divided by a polynomial. This is a polynomial of degree 1. Okay? So this is polynomial degree 1. Okay? The next one is a little bit more complicated, but I can simplify this by multiplying the top and the bottom by 1 minus B2 epsilon. Okay, so in the numerator, I will have b0 times 1 minus b2 epsilon. And in the denominator, I'm going to have 1 minus b1 epsilon minus b2 epsilon. Okay, so now we have this is a polynomial of degree 1, and this is a polynomial of degree 1. Okay, and if you keep simplifying, of course, this gets worse. The next one is b0 over 1 minus b1 epsilon, 1 minus b2 epsilon over 1 minus b3 epsilon. This gets more complicated, okay? But you can rationalize this. It's no big deal. And if you do, what you find is that this has the structure of a polynomial of degree 1 divided by a polynomial of degree 2. Okay? So first, polynomial of degree 0 over 0, then 0 over 1, then 1 over 1, then 1 over 2, then 2 over 2, then 2 over 3, and so on. Okay? And this sequence of ratios of polynomials is called a Padé sequence. In fact, these are called Padés. It's named after Henri Padé, okay, important guy. And so this is called the diagonal Padé sequence. Okay, and so the notation that is used is so this thing is called P00. of epsilon. Of course, it isn't a function of epsilon because it's just a number over a number. Okay. The next one is called P01 of epsilon. The next one is called P11 of epsilon, P12 of epsilon, and so on. Okay. Now, the point here is that this sequence, in general, looks like you can see there are two subsequences here, obviously. Okay. There's one sequence of the form PNN of epsilon. Okay. So that's every other number is of the form PNN. So this is P00, there's P11, there's P22. Okay? So there's that sequence. And then there is the sequence PNN plus 1 of epsilon. Okay? So this term and this term and so on. Okay? And when you put this together with this, you get this long sequence of structures. That, again, is called the diagonal Padé sequence. And the issue is whether or not this Padé sequence converges. What are the conditions for this thing to converge? How does it look like? You know, what does it look like when it's converging? Okay, and why does it converge? And basically, people don't understand, in any general sense, the answer to those questions. It's just not known. Okay, so I'm going to tell you what is known, but this is a remarkable mathematical structure that should be investigated, and there are literally hundreds of theses that have to be written about this. It's just not understood. Why really does it work? Okay, it's really tricky. Okay? So just one obvious remark, just last obvious remark, and that is that if you're trying to construct Padés, you don't have to construct, these are called Padé approximants. This is called a Padé approximant. These things are called Padé approximants. And in general, a Padé approximant can have the form P, M, N. And it doesn't have to be that M and N are equal or M and N differ by 1. It doesn't have to be that. In fact, you can make what is called a Padé table. So given a Taylor-like series, I can't call this a Taylor series. I can only call this a Taylor series if it converges. But I can call it a Taylor-like series, or more precisely, an asymptotic series. So given an asymptotic series, A sub n epsilon to the n, given this, I can construct a Padé table. Okay, so I can construct the entries. Here's m this way, and n is that way. Okay, and I can use this to construct this series. And what we are talking about when we're talking about the diagonal Padé sequence are these terms. This is the m equals n term, and then there's one just shifted, you know, where this differs by 1. Okay, so around here are the diagonal entries of the Padé sequence, but we could go way off diagonal. We could use those too. Okay, so these are the things that we want to discuss. Yeah?
So how are the way off diagonal terms defined? I mean, it doesn't come out of this.
Sure it is. So if you want to calculate an off-diagonal Padé sequence, no problem. What you know, so in such a Padé sequence, what this means, what this guy is a polynomial of degree m divided by a polynomial of degree n. So let me ask you, how many coefficients, how many numbers do we have to determine in order to find all the coefficients in this polynomial? How many numbers are there to be determined here? Say it again? No. OK, the answer you gave was m plus n plus 2. That's because there are n plus 1 coefficients here and n plus 1 coefficients here, but that's not correct. Why not?
Because they are ones.
Say it again?
They are ones.
That's right. We can always, because this is a ratio, there aren't that many coefficients. There's one less, right? There's one less. So we can assume, for example, that the polynomial in the denominator has the form 1 plus, you know, or the coefficient of the highest power is 1 times epsilon to the n plus, and so on. We can always assume that. So there are really m plus n plus 1 coefficients. Excuse me. So that's the number of coefficients. And to find that number of coefficients, we need m plus n plus 1 pieces of information. So how do we get those, that number of pieces of information? Well, we need to take the perturbation series and sum that perturbation series up to the m plus n term. And that will have exactly m plus n plus 1 coefficients, a sub n epsilon to the n. And now, to find the coefficients in these polynomials, the routine is absolutely straightforward. You take the right-hand side of this. You expand it in a Taylor series. You match the coefficients in the Taylor series. That gives you altogether m plus n plus 1 equations. You solve those equations. Those are all simple algebraic equations. And they're simple and linear algebraic equations in the sense that each new unknown appears just to the first power. The equations themselves are not linear. They involve powers. But as you calculate, as you solve them equation by equation, everything is unique. Everything is completely uniquely determined. There are no plus or minuses or something like that coming up. Yeah?
So, but we could get the same coefficients if you go down the diagonal far enough.
Oh, they won't be the same. In general, they will always be different coefficients. Okay, so the polynomial corresponding to 3, 7, this polynomial, suppose you're looking for the 3, 7 pade.
Right.
The coefficients in this and this polynomial will be determined in this fashion. If you then look at the 5, 9, they have no relation to one another. They're always different. Okay? So there's nothing that remains invariant as you add on. You have to start from the beginning and find the full pade approximate. Okay? Now, so the question is, why should the pade be better than the Taylor series? What is it about the pade that in some sense improves the numerics? And the answer is, I can only give you a very, very heuristic, sloppy answer. And the answer is, does anybody, why should pades be better than a Taylor series? The answer is, you want to?
Well, it doesn't converge in the circle or of the.
It certainly doesn't converge in a circle, but pades are in some sense better. And the answer is that these pades, see, a Taylor series only converges in a circle, and it ceases to converge when there is some singularity in the complex plane. What is it that sets the radius of convergence of this Taylor series? The answer is straightforward. The answer is that in the complex epsilon plane, there is some singularity over here. And as soon as you bump into the nearest singularity, that determines the radius of convergence of the circle. That's it. Okay? There may be further singularities. In fact, in general, there are an infinite number of singularities. They may be very complicated. But it's the nearest singularity that determines the radius of convergence. Okay? So what is it that the pades do that's so great? The answer is, you see, there are polynomials in the denominator. Suppose this singularity is a pole. And that was indeed the case for when we were trying to sum the series 1 plus 2 plus 4 plus, right? And you could replace this by 1 plus 2 epsilon plus 4 epsilon squared and so on. And there is a singularity. Why do the pades work? Because that singularity is a pole. And the pod A already has a polynomial in the denominator that could explain the pole, that incorporates that pole. So the pod A can converge everywhere except at that pole. Okay? However, there might be other kinds of singularities. For example, there could be a branch cut. Right? If we're trying to calculate, if you're trying to calculate the function the square root of 1 plus z, okay? Suppose this is the exact answer to the problem. You'd love it if that were the exact answer, because it's nice and simple. But suppose that was the exact answer. Okay? Then what is the nature of this function here? Well, this square root of 1 plus z, you are calculating it as a perturbation series, a sub n, z to the n. What's the radius of convergence of that perturbation series? Say it again. Say it loud. What is it?
One.
Sure. Because in the complex z plane, where's the singularity? At minus 1. Okay, here's the singularity at minus 1. So we know that this perturbation series converges in a circle of radius 1. And it stops converging outside that circle. Okay? But what is the nature of the singularity now? It's not a pole. It's a branch cut. And this branch cut goes, out to infinity. Why would the pod A work now? Well, I'm now going to use the words that people who use pod A's use, but it's a peculiar use of the word. The word is mocking up. Okay? So as you go to higher and higher pod A's, the polynomial in the denominator has more and more zeros. And these zeros tend to become dense on that cut, closer and closer. Of course, those zeros of the polynomials just make poles. So you get a line of poles. But this line of poles becomes denser and denser and denser. And in some sense, it fuses into a cut. And intuitively, that's how the pod A works. Now, that's really intuitive mathematics. But I'm going to show you, in some cases, that this can be made rigorous. Yeah?
The branch cut doesn't really have a very sharp existence. Right?
Exactly. Exactly. So these poles of the pod A are fixed. And I told you that the branch cut, not the branch point, the branch point is located at a specific, that's a characteristic of the function. But where you decide to draw the branch cut is your own business. But the pod A's draw it for you. Okay? So the pod A's say, we insist that the cut is right here, and these poles are becoming dense over there, and that is the function that the pod A converges to. Typically, when the pod A's converge to a function with a cut, they converge in the cut plane. They converge everywhere except on that line of poles, which are now fusing into a cut as n goes to infinity. It's quite remarkable mathematics, okay? And not completely understood. Yeah?
But the branch cut is, it's continuous while
the poles are discrete. Yes, and as n goes to infinity, they are becoming denser and denser.
But they're still massively infinite.
Indeed, of course. Just the way the rationals are countably infinite, but they are dense on the real line. Okay? So the distance between the poles is going to zero as n goes to infinity. Okay? So you pick a patch here, and as n gets large enough, there will be a pole in it. Okay, so you take a smaller patch, and as n goes to infinity, there will be a pole in it. And there will be a pole in any interval, no matter how small, of size epsilon, as n goes to infinity. So that in that sense, the poles are mocking up the cut. And so the word is, this doesn't sound like mathematics, but this is a technical term. Okay? Okay, so the poles, do you understand what I mean by the poles? The zeros of the polynomial and the denominator are mocking up the cut. And of course, there may be several cuts. Okay, and the poles may become dense on several cuts, several different cuts. Yeah?
What happens if you have an essential singularity?
Then, again, there may well be an essential singularity because you may have a limit point of branch points. And you remember I showed that to you. This is very important. Okay? Typically, however, this essential singularity is on the second sheet. That is, you typically find that that essential singularity if you go through this cut and come out on the second sheet. But the pade only converges typically on the first sheet. It converges in a cut plane. And that these essential singularities that occur typically are not on that first sheet. If you have an essential singularity, okay, the pade may converge. Pades may converge, may not converge. And this is a non-trivial question. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. Sometimes they do, and it's unexplained why they do. I'm going to show that to you. Okay, so this is, you have to write a thesis on this. I mean, this is what I'm showing you is cutting-edge mathematics. And so I can't always explain. So the pades typically work. Not absolutely always, but they work even when it is impossible to explain why they're working. Okay? It's quite interesting. Yeah?
I don't know if it makes much sense, but the fact that the pade chooses one specific cut,
mm-hmm. like, does it mean this chooses the location of the cut.
Does that mean that there is one position of the cut that's more?
No, it's because the pades are converging to a function that is Herglotz. Herglotz. And I'm going to define that for you. So the pades, the point is, there may be many functions. If you have a divergent series, an asymptotic series, if you have a given function and you expand it in an asymptotic series, the coefficients in that series are unique. But there may be another function which has exactly the same asymptotic series. In fact, there may be typically an infinite number of functions. The pades converge to that function which there's a symmetry in the upper half, a symmetry of what's going on in the upper half plane and the lower half plane. And the pades want to converge to such a function having that symmetry. And that symmetry is called Herglotz symmetry, okay, which we're going to talk about. Okay? So the pades choose which of those functions they're going to converge to. And typically, the function they converge to is the function that we are looking for as physicists, which is remarkable. I'm going to have to show that to you. Okay? Okay. Yes?
What happens if you integrate, you have your pade sequence and you have like this marking of the branch cut and you do an integration?
It depends what you're talking about. If you do an integral, I mean, it depends what you mean. If all the poles are over here, okay, and you do an integral like this, then you are enclosing no singularities, and you know Cauchy's theorem as well as I do. The answer is zero.
What I mean is,
if you wait a minute. It's zero, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You agree. So the pades have no problem with that. Of course, maybe you want to push this off to infinity, but the pade doesn't converge in infinity. It converges in the finite cut plane. If you go off to infinity, pade may not be giving you a correct representation of the function.
What I say is simple. If you have your branch cut here and you do an integration group, if it crosses the branch cut,
are you going to close the
zero?
Are you closing your contour or not?
Yeah.
Are you enclosing any singularities?
If I have a pade, we have this thing here.
Yeah. Yes.
If you do this thing here.
Sure. Then you pick up the residue of that pole.
Yeah. But if I had a branch cut, I could contract this.
Yes. Thing. Yes. 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 But that's not, remember, that is not a closed contour. If you would like to integrate this thing, that's fine. You can integrate around a pole, and you pick up the residue of the pole. Okay? However, That is not a closed contour. And you promised me you would draw a closed contour. Can you tell me why that's not a closed contour? The function has a branch cut. That is not closed. Because if you cross the branch cut, you're on a different sheet. So that's not a closed contour. Of course, you can draw a contour for this polynomial approximation. But the function is not a single-valued function. So therefore, when you draw a contour like this, you're leaving this thing is not a closed contour. So you do not, you know, it's a closed contour for your approximation. But it's not a closed contour. I mean, look, you're asking me a very simple question. Suppose I have a very complicated function, and I expand it in a Taylor series, a sub n, x to the n. We can even assume the Taylor series converges. And now you're saying to me something like, well, why don't we take the first three terms in this series, which is a polynomial, you know, a0 plus a1x plus a2x squared. That's a polynomial. And you're saying to me, but this isn't a polynomial. Well, of course it's not a polynomial. Okay, this only equals this in the limit as n goes to infinity. Right? But in that limit, you are enclosing the residues of an infinite number of poles. So this is some serious calculation you're talking about. But for finite n, for finite n, your contour encloses a finite number of poles, which are the zeros of this denominator. Okay, so this is a very, you know, this class is, the same thing is happening now. Rather than allowing me to go ahead and tell you something, you're making up interesting questions. And they're not really relevant. And I actually, some of these questions you're asking are not very important at all. Okay? And so what is, so it's taking up time. And I'd love to chat with you after the lecture, if you're interested in doing that. Okay? Actually, last year, students spent a lot of time at lunch coming up and chatting, and it hasn't happened this year much. So I don't know, maybe you're afraid of me, or else you're finding this course really boring, one of the two. But please come up to me, and we'll work this out. We'll do some calculations, if you like. Okay, but this is not terribly relevant to what, to where we're going. Okay, this is a very narrow technical question. And you understand that contour is not an interesting contour for the function we're representing, because typically the function we're representing has a cut. That's not a closed contour. It's a closed contour for the approximation, but it's not a closed contour for the function that approximation is representing. Okay? So this function is defined this function is defined on a Riemann surface. Those approximations are only defined on a one-sheeted complex plane, because this is very simple. These approximants just have poles, and that's all. Right? So they're different in the same sense that this polynomial is different from that function, and you understand this perfectly well. So what I have told you is that the pad A, if it's really working well, converges only on a cut plane, and that's all. That's what I've told you. So it's the approximation, the approximants are not equal to the function, but they are converging. They are coming arbitrarily close to the function in that cut plane, in that cut plane. Not outside the cut plane, not if you draw a contour like that, because you're going outside the cut plane. Okay? So, okay, so the question is, can we look at some cases where we just blindly attempt to calculate the pad A approximants from the continued fraction and see if they work? You got to see if they work before, you know, before we try to prove something rigorously. So let's take a look. Okay, so I have a bunch of trial studies here, okay, which Tiber was very nice to Xerox and put together. So I'm going to show you a bunch of numerical data. Let's see, do we have? Yeah, we do. So first of all, the first question I asked was, let's take a series that converges perfectly well. Let's take the function e to the x. Okay? Couldn't be simpler. We know that the Taylor series for this function converges for all x in the complex x plane, except at infinity, right? In the finite plane. Okay? So here's the Taylor series. So if we wish to calculate e to the x, of course it's very efficient just to sum the series. This is a very nice function. Okay? Now, so what I'm going to do, however, is I'm going to take that Taylor series and pade it. Okay, I'm using pade as a verb here. Okay? So I'm going to take that Taylor series, I'm going to pade the Taylor series, and compare the pade approximants, okay, to the Taylor approximants. So the game is this. I'm going to take n terms in the Taylor series. I'm going to use those n terms to construct the pade approximant, okay? And I'm going to use the same amount of information. So there are two choices. I can use the raw Taylor series, or I can process that Taylor series, construct the pade approximant, and see what the pade approximant says. So for example, just for example, suppose I take the first four terms in the Taylor series. That corresponds to p to n equals 3. Okay? And I'm going to do this at x equals 1. Okay? So at x equals 1, the function e to the x is just e, which is 2.71828, 1828. Okay? And for n equals 3, the answer is 2.66667. Okay? Which is pretty good. We're getting very close to 2.71828, right? And the pade I'm going to construct, since I have, since n equals 3, the pade I can construct is P12, for example, if I'm going to construct a diagonal pade, and I get 2.66667. Not too impressive. However, if you look closely, and if you calculate the relative error, it's the same. So this is the percentage error. Okay, so let's go down a little bit further. Okay, so let's take n equals 13. Okay, so for n equals 13, if you add up the Taylor series, you get 2.71828. That's the answer. Okay, that's what we're looking for, and you can compute the pade P67. So there's a seventh degree polynomial in the denominator and a sixth degree polynomial in the numerator. And now you have to go to many decimal places to see how accurate you are. And you notice the Taylor series, the error in the Taylor series, is 4 times 10 to the minus 12. Okay? The error in the pade is 7 times 10 to the minus 15. So you see what happened. We extracted more information by first padeing the Taylor series and then calculating the pade approximant rather than just adding up the Taylor series, even though the Taylor series is rapidly convergent. Okay? Now, this fact, the fact that you do slightly better if you use pades, this has been proved. Okay? There is a paper that shows that this works for this particular function. But in general, it's very hard to prove, as you can imagine. This is really hard to prove. If you go further, like let's take n equals 20, the answer, of course, to this number of decimal places, you can't see any difference between the pade and the Taylor series. But if you look at the error in the Taylor series, the error is 7 times 10 to the minus 21, whereas the error in the pade is 1 times 10 to the minus 25. So we pick up an additional factor of something 10,000 or 100,000 here, which is pretty damn impressive. It's magic. And in a sense, what I'm teaching you is magic, and it isn't completely understood. So given a series, even if it's a convergent series, even if it's a convergent Taylor series that has an infinite radius of convergence, would you add up the series? No. The stupidest thing you can ever do with a series is add it up. First, you tickle the series, and you cajole it to releasing more information than you get just by adding up the Taylor series. Okay? Now, there's a reason why this is working, okay, intuitively. Okay? What's the reason that it's working? Well, if you imagine the function e to the x, the function e to the x is a very, whoops, klutz. Okay, if you look at the function e to the x, it's a very interesting function. Okay? It looks like this. If you make a plot of the function, here's x. E to the x looks like this. It's getting very big over here, and it's getting very small over here. Now, a Taylor series, if it converges, converges in a circle. That means that the Taylor series has a lot of work to do. Okay? Why does it have a lot of work to do? Because when you add up the terms in the Taylor series, there has to be almost an exact cancellation to produce an extremely small number over there, exponentially small number, in fact, to be precise. And these terms in the Taylor series have to conspire to add together to produce a very big number over here. So the Taylor series has to do a lot of very hard work. Whereas the Pade has the ability to have zeros in the denominator, which is a very easy way to make big numbers. Okay? So the Taylor series is much better, the Pade sequence is much better suited to describe a function that has different behaviors. Remember, Taylor series, if it's going to converge, converges in a circle and has to represent all those behaviors simultaneously. But a Pade doesn't have to do that. It's not as hard for a Pade to do that. Okay? So it's in a much better mood. Okay? So now, I'm going to do exactly the same thing, except over here, I'm going to take the Pade sequence for the function e to the x, okay? But now, I'm going to do it, this is out of order. Right. Just a second. Yeah. Where did I do that? How did I? Just a second.
Did the mouse fell?
Oh, when it fell, I'm sorry. Yeah. Ah, there we go. Yeah. So here is the Pade sequence for the same function, e to the x. But now I'm going to evaluate it at a bigger value of x. Okay? Now, again, let's see what happens. So, for example, if you want to know e to the x, of course, at x equals 5, that's e to the fifth power, right? What's e cubed? What is e cubed equal to? 20. You should know that. It's almost exactly 20. You should know that. Okay. So e to the fifth is 20 times e squared, okay? Which is about 148, something like that. Okay? So if you take, for example, 26 terms, let's just go right to the bottom of the table, 26 terms in the Taylor series, it tells you the answer is 148, which is a very good answer. And the pod A that you construct is also giving you the same answer. But look at the error. The error in the Taylor series is 10 to the minus 12. But in the pod A sequence, that number, that pod A, is 10 to the minus 17. Okay? Quite remarkable. Okay. Now, let's look. This is a really strange thing. This is not something that you might think of doing. The function e to the x is a function you know and love. And you understand that what the Taylor series looks like. How about the function gamma of x? Okay, so the question is, can you tell me about the function gamma of x? What does the function gamma of x look like? (Clears throat) What does the function gamma of x look like? Make a plot.
Exponential growth.
It's much faster than exponential growth. How fast does it grow? How does gamma of x grow for large x? It's factorial growth, that's right. So it's x to the x, not just e to the x. It's x to the x, which is much, much, much faster. Okay, the ratio of x to the x divided by e to the x is infinity, right? So it grows extremely rapidly. Okay, so this is growing roughly like x to the x e to the minus x. And that's given by the Stirling approximation. Okay, now it comes down, however, and it hits a minimum. Okay, so gamma of 2, what is gamma of 2? Here's 2. What is gamma of 2 equal to?
1.
And what's gamma of 1 equal to? 1. Okay, so at 1, the gamma function is 1, and at 2, the gamma function is 1. It hits a minimum in between. The minimum is not exactly halfway between, but it's roughly 1.5. It's a little bit bigger than 1.5. Okay? It then, so it passes through 1 here and 1 here, and then it comes up and it blows up at the origin. Okay? And then? What does it do? You know what it does. Okay. So it has a simple pole at the origin, and then it comes up like this. And then at minus 1, there's another pole. So it blows up, and it comes down like this, and it blows up like this, and it comes down like this. And it has poles for all the negative integers and 0. Okay. So in the complex plane, here's gamma of z in the complex plane. Gamma of z is not an analytic function. It has poles here, 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 and so on. Okay? So these are the poles. However, is gamma of z ever 0? The answer is no. So the function 1 over gamma of z is an analytic function. It is an entire function, okay? So 1 over gamma of z has a Taylor series of the form sum from n equals 0 to infinity, a sub n z to the n. And this Taylor series exists for all finite z, converges for all z, okay? Now, however, this Taylor series, where does this Taylor series begin? What is the first term in the Taylor series? What's the n equals 0? What's the coefficient of n equals 0, that a 0 term in the Taylor series? Say it again.
Zero,
of course, because the function is blowing up. 1 over the function blows up, right? So the first, so this is really a Taylor series that begins at n equals 1. Okay? So before I can convert, if I wish to take this Taylor series as before and convert it to a pod A sequence, I would like the first term in that series to be 1. So I will just divide by z, put a z up here, and now this function here, z over gamma of z, is now going to begin at 0, okay? Is that clear? Oh, I'm sorry, z gamma of z, long side, z gamma of z. And now this function, so this is the Taylor series for 1 over z gamma of z. Okay? And this series, remember, has an infinite radius of convergence. Now let me tell you about this series. Remember, the radius of convergence of this series is infinite, so it must be a rapidly converging series. However, I dare you to calculate gamma of z using its Taylor series. It's hopeless. You can't do that. It's absolutely hopeless. Okay? So if you start adding up the terms in the Taylor series, take 6 terms in the Taylor series and try to calculate gamma of 1, it'll give you an answer like 16. It takes forever to get there. It will get there, and it will become arbitrarily accurate, but you need huge numbers of terms in the series. Why is the Taylor series so lousy? This is the tortoise and the hare problem. Why is the Taylor series so lousy? Yeah.
Because the gamma function behaves so well differently in different senses.
Precisely the point. Okay, that's the point I was just making before, and now it's more dramatic. On the positive real axis, the gamma function is blowing up like x to the x. Just blowing up like crazy. Okay? Over here, here on this positive axis, it's blowing up like crazy. Here, it's got a sequence of poles, so the gamma function is behaving like a mirror morphic function. It's a sequence of poles. Completely different behaviors. So we're talking about 1 over that function, but 1 over that function has to behave like this. It has to vanish, 1 over gamma z has to vanish at an incredible rate as z goes to infinity, as z runs, you know, gets larger and larger on the real axis. But on the negative axis, it passes through a bunch of zeros, which is completely different behavior. So the Taylor series stinks. Okay? It's really horrible. But if you construct the Padés, you can get approximations that are extremely accurate for reasons that have not been explained. There isn't any paper that explains why the Padé is working so well. It just does. Okay? It's quite incredible. So if you have a Taylor series and you try to add up this Taylor series, it'll take you all day, even though the radius of convergence of the Taylor series is so big. It's really startling. Okay? Now, here is a function that this is the typical function that people use when they try to explain Padé sequences. And we're going to use this function. We're going to talk about the theory of Padé in the next lecture. But the typical function that is used is this function log of 1 plus x over x. Log of 1 plus x over x. Okay? Now, this function is singular at x equals 0, right? I mean, there's a, you know, this is f of x. Okay. This function is singular at x equals 0, yes? Just checking. I just want to see if you're listening. Okay. Of course not. The numerator vanishes at x equals 0 because log of 1 is 0. The denominator vanishes. This function is analytic at x equals 0. However, so it looks like there's a pole here, but there isn't. Okay. However, there is a singularity in this function. Where is the singularity? At x equals minus 1. So in the complex x-plane, here's the complex x-plane, there is a singularity at minus 1, right? And what is that singularity? It's a branch cut singularity, right? And there is some branch cut that goes off. I claim that the Padé converges to the function where the branch cut is drawn on the negative real axis. Okay? So I claim the Padé converges everywhere to this sheet, to the function on the cut plane with a cut on the negative real axis. Okay? And I want to show you. So, of course, the Taylor series converges in a circle of radius 1, which is just a circle, and the Padé converges in this entire cut plane everywhere except on that cut. Okay? Now, to see this, and this is truly remarkable. This is really quite amazing. let's look at this. Okay, so here are the PNNs. Okay, just the sequence of PNNs, and I've calculated at three different values of x. First, I take x equals 1/2, so we're inside of the circle of convergence. Then I take x equals 1, so I'm on the circle of convergence. And then I take x equals 2. Okay? And I want you to look at the way the Padés converge. You notice here this is point 812, 810, 810. It's going down, down, down. It's monotonically decreasing. You see that? So here, if you look at these Padés, you can see them getting smaller and smaller and smaller, monotone decreasing. strictly monotone decreasing. These are all monotone decreasing, getting smaller and smaller. On the other hand, the Pn, n plus 1s, as n gets bigger, are monotone increasing. And the exact, and both sequences, this sequence converges to the right answer. Okay, so for example, at x equals 2, the function is converging to the log of 3 over 2, 1 half the log of 3. Okay, and you can see this is converging downward, this is converging upward, and the correct answer is trapped in between. So the nth Pade approximant provides for you an upper bound and a lower bound. And the bounds are getting sharper and sharper. And as you use more and more terms in the Taylor series, the calculation gets more and more accurate. And you not only know what it's tending to, but you have an upper bound on the error. And furthermore, what should you do? Suppose you get tired after calculating 5 Pades or 10 Pades. What do you do next? Of course, you don't have to stop there, because you know how to extrapolate a monotone sequence. So there's even more information buried, because you can Richardson the Pades. Okay? Which is fantastic. Or you can Shanks the full Pade sequence, because it's an oscillating sequence. So you could take this sequence and Richardson it, or Richardson this sequence, or you could Shanks the entire sequence, or another thing you could do would be to take subsequent averages. There's no end to the amount of play you can have, right? You can take subsequent averages, and the average of just two successive terms will also be an oscillating sequence, okay? Which is very, very close to the limit, and then you can Shanks that sequence. Okay, so there's no end to the amount of fun you can have, okay? Now, this function, the reason why I'm taking this function is an example, a simple example, of a function of Stieltjes. And the one function for which it is, one class of functions for which it is rigorously understood that the Pades converge are Stieltjes functions. Okay, and for Stieltjes functions, the Pades are known rigorously to converge in a cut plane. This is fantastic. It's absolutely fantastic, right? So, I mean, so you see what we've done. All we did was to take this Taylor series, which is horrible because it only converges in this circle, just convert it algebraically to a Pade sequence, and bang, it converges everywhere except on that cut. And of course, what is happening, just one last comment, what is happening on this cut is that the poles, you can calculate where the poles are, and the poles are becoming denser and denser and denser on that cut. They're mocking up the cut. And that is what is happening. It's quite remarkable. Yeah.
Is it interesting to know what Stieltjes functions are?
Yes, of course. We're going to define them precisely. That's. So I want to first show you the numerics, but then next time we're going to define a Stieltjes function, and I'm going to recite for you the theorems. And show you and indicate to you a little bit here and there what the proof looks like. Just in some cases, just an indication. Okay. Okay. Here, just a few more examples. Okay. So here, so I took this series. The series. What does the series look like here? What is the series for log of x? This is 1 over x. What is the what does the Taylor series for log of x look like? Say it again. Over n. That's right. So the Taylor series looks like for log of 1 plus x, for small x, it looks like x minus x squared over 2 plus x cubed over 3 minus x to the fourth over 4, and so on, divided by x, which gives you the series 1 minus x over 2 plus x squared over 3, and so on. That's what the series is. However, here, I'm taking a series that has a zero radius of convergence. And this is another classic Stieltjes function. This is the series minus x to the n times n factorial. And this is the kind of series you get when you do quantum field theory. Okay, so this has a zero radius of convergence. And what I'm doing is using, of course, this, you cannot use the Taylor series to calculate this function for any value of x, except, of course, x equals 0, okay, which is the unperturbed problem, which you don't care about. Okay? So what I'm doing is taking this series, converting it to a pod A, and now that pod A sequence converges everywhere, everywhere in the entire cut plane. Okay? Except on the cut, on the negative real axis. And these are the PNNs. So for n equals 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So just the first few terms in the series. At x equals 1, I want you to notice, again, that this is a monotone decreasing sequence. 666, 615, 602, 598, 597, 596. And it's stabilized at 596. Whereas PNN plus 1 is a monotone increasing sequence. Okay, and it is converging from above and below, and the pod A's, the diagonal sequence of pod A's, are giving you upper and lower bounds on the sum of that divergent series, which is amazing. Okay. Now, of course, you know how to sum that series because you have because I've taught you Borel summation. Okay, so for this particular series, you know the nth term in the series. So the Borel sum of the series, the Borel sum of that series is, okay, so you're given a series minus x to the n over n factorial from 0 to infinity. To calculate the Borel sum, you divide by n factorial and you integrate from 0 to infinity e to the minus t, t to the n dt. You interchange orders of, sorry, this is times n factorial. You interchange orders of integration and summation, and you cancel the n factorial. And therefore, the sum of the series is the integral from 0 to infinity, dt, e to the minus t, 1 over 1 plus xt. Okay? And what you are seeing here, so we know what the exact answer is. But when we do quantum field theory, we can't do this because we don't know more than the first five terms in the asymptotic series. You can't, you're not strong enough to calculate more than a handful of Feynman diagrams. Okay? Even if you're Tiber and you work very, very hard, you know. So what you see here is that the pod A's are converging and providing an upper and lower bound on the correct answer. And this is astonishing. And this is the reason why we use Feynman diagrams. Can't use them otherwise. It's just an exercise in futility. Okay? Now, here is something really strange. And I'm kind of proud of this thing. Okay. So I talked to you before about the gamma function. Okay? The gamma function has a Taylor series. One over the gamma function has a Taylor series at the origin. But there is also a divergent series called the Stirling series. And the Stirling series is written down over here. Okay. You see, there is an x over e times, see this over here? X over e to the x times the square root of 2 pi over xp. Okay? So what is the Stirling series? Gamma of x has an asymptotic approximation which is extremely famous. It's called the Stirling series. And this asymptotic series is valid as x goes to plus infinity. Okay? And this series looks like this, square root of 2 pi over the square root of x, x to the x, e to the minus x. That's not a series. That's just a function. And it's multiplied by a series. Okay, and the series has the form a over a plus b over x plus c over x squared plus d over x cubed. And this is valid as x goes to infinity. Okay? For the Stirling series, the Stirling coefficients, a is equal to 1, obviously. B is equal to 1/12. C is equal to 1 over 244. That's not right. 1 over 280. 1 over 280. And it goes on. Okay? I'm still wrong. 1 over 288. That's what it is. 1 over 288. And it goes on, and the numbers become more and more complicated. And the pattern, the sign pattern in this series is plus, 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 and then minus, minus, plus, plus, minus, minus, plus, plus, and so on. Okay? Now, this Stirling series is a divergent series. However, if you use this series to calculate the gamma function, and you use just the first few terms in the series, it gives you a very accurate approximation to the gamma function. You want to know what 3 factorial is? 3 is so close to infinity that the Stirling series is very accurate. Of course, if you take too many terms in the Stirling series, this series diverges, so it gives you infinity. So what happens is, as you take more and more terms in the Stirling series, the error goes down, 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 until you reach a minimum error, and that gives you a very accurate approximation. And then the error gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and it goes off to infinity. So for each value of x, you can only take a finite number of terms in this series. Then you have to stop including terms in the series. So there's an optimal accuracy that is available from the Stirling series. The Taylor series converges everywhere, but it takes forever to get there. The Stirling series gets there really fast. Why is the Stirling series so much more useful if you don't need infinite precision? Because the Stirling series is valid as x goes to infinity. And in fact, it's only valid in the complex plane, in this part of the complex plane, but not including the negative axis. Okay? So you understand there's a very big difference between the Taylor series, which is valid in the entire complex plane, and the Stirling series, which is only valid up to but not on the negative axis. So you're not asking the Stirling series to do as much as the Taylor series. So what I did was then to take the Stirling series, where you can only take a few terms and then these numbers begin to grow and you have to stop using the Stirling series. And I padded this. That is, I treated 1 over x as epsilon, and I constructed a padé from those numbers. Why not? It's a divergent series. Let's padé it. Okay? And what you get is absolutely fantastic. Okay? So if you look at these padés, I'm using the Stirling series to calculate, and you can look at these in greater detail later if you want. Okay? But if you take this divergent series, convert it to a padé, now this is so much better than the Taylor series that there's not even a faint comparison. So a guy walks up to you on the street. He says, I need to calculate the gamma function, okay, with tremendous precision. What do I do? Well, if you're not too sophisticated, what you say is, look, 1 over the gamma function is entire. The Taylor series converges for all x, okay? So you add up the Taylor series for 1 over gamma, and then you take its reciprocal, and that's how you calculate gamma. Bing. Turns out that's the worst advice you could have given the guy. Rather, you just take the Stirling series, okay, and you padé this, and you can get arbitrarily accurate, because the fact that the Stirling series is diverging is not relevant as far as padé is concerned, you can get arbitrarily accurate answers, and you get it with an infinitesimal amount of work compared with the amount of work it takes to calculate the sum of the Taylor series. It's quite remarkable. Two ways to calculate the gamma function, the Taylor series, which converges everywhere but which stinks, or the Stirling series, which is a divergent series, which gives you arbitrarily accurate answers in essentially no work at all. Yeah?
Mathematica is able to compute
The factorials very, very accurately.
Yes.
Does it use the Stirling?
In fact, of course, that's... So So a factorial, of course, is very simple to calculate. But if I wanted to calculate gamma of 71.4 plus 6i, okay, how would I do it? Okay. This is the natural way to do it. You could use the Taylor series, but the computer would run all night, okay? Or you could use this technique, and this is a very, very accurate way of getting the answer. And I think I have just one more thing to show you. So this is another example. These functions are called parabolic cylinder functions, and actually we discussed parabolic cylinder functions yesterday at lunch. You came by and was mentioning. So these are parabolic cylinder functions. Parabolic cylinder functions are solutions to the Schrodinger equation for the harmonic oscillator. Okay, but they're general solutions, not just for the eigenvalues of the harmonic oscillator, but for arbitrary energy. Okay, and the parabolic cylinder function is an entire function. Its Taylor series converges for all x. So suppose you had the following problem. You need to calculate the parabolic cylinder function, let's say for lots of values of x. There are two ways you could calculate it. You could work out the Taylor series and then sum the Taylor series. Or you could find the series at infinity, which is an asymptotic series and which diverges. Okay? Now, suppose you needed to calculate the parabolic cylinder function at 1. Is 1 closer to 0 or closer to infinity? 1 is very close to infinity as far as the pade is concerned. Okay? So all you have to do is pade the divergent series that is valid at infinity at x equals 1. And when you do that, you get these phenomenally accurate approximations. Okay, and you could look at these in more, since we're running over time, you could look at this in more detail later on. This is absolutely amazing. So this is the technique. If you're calculating special functions, you're making tables, you know, like from the NBS handbook, how would you do it? Would you use the Taylor series? Naively, you would say, of course you use the Taylor series. It converges for all x. There are no singularities except at infinity. Wrong. What you do is you use the divergent series, valid at infinity, not valid at 0, which is a divergent series, right? No problem. You pade it. And then you calculate the pade sequence, and the rate, the amount, the number of pen strokes required, amount of work that you need to do, the number of seconds of computer time, will be incredibly small compared with just summing up the Taylor series. Yeah?
Why is it better to pade the asymptotic series than the Taylor series?
Why is it better to... Oh, because the Taylor series is trying to do too much. That's why. You could, of course, if you said to me, you have to add up the Taylor series, I would never do such a thing. I'd pade it first. But even if I pade the Taylor series, it takes forever to converge. Okay, it does better than just adding up the Taylor series, but it's far too slow. So if I take the asymptotic series, the asymptotic series is only valid in a limited region in the complex plane. So when I typically a cut plane, it doesn't try to do as much as the Taylor series, and so it works better. Okay, that's an intuitive answer. I haven't given you a rigorous mathematical answer because I can't. I can't do that. It's just, you know, this is, all of these functions could be studied. You could take one such function and study it and write a thesis on it. Okay. Why it converges, how fast it converges, you know, that kind of thing. This is really interesting. Okay? So this was an attempt at salesmanship. Okay? I showed you a bunch of answers. Next time we have to discuss the theory, and that's the plan for Monday. And then I want to do, I've left you hanging. Do you remember we started to do a calculation? And we found, remember, for that integral e to the minus x squared minus x to the 4, and we got a divergent series. That's a field theory. And I want to go back to that, and I want to show you the pade results for that divergent series and show you that it works. We can get the answer. It's quite beautiful. Okay. All right. Any more questions or anything? Great. Okay.
So, there is a homework. So, this is ready, but it gives us a lot of homework.
Yes,